necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests. And, well, today our special guest is Mr. William Federer. We're going to be talking about the history of Mexico. Now, we hear a lot about Mexico today, about immigration, about Vicente Fox, and a lot of people ask, why is it that we just don't seem to be able to control illegal immigration? And we're told we have about 12 million illegal immigrants in America, but then, of course, when did the government ever tell you the truth? I will tell you what the government tells my friends, and I have a friend who actually went to a meeting put on by one of the branches of the government that admitted there are 20 million illegal immigrants in America today. The president says, well, certainly I'm against amnesty. We're not going to give them amnesty. We're just going to let them stay in the country and become citizens. Some people think that that's an inconsistent statement, but then the president says, you know, the language of this country should be English and everybody should speak English, and yet if you go to his website, most of his major speeches are available both in English and in Spanish. Nothing is, it appears to be. And let me suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, if you think that sometimes you're a little confused, no, you're not confused. You're seeing things as they really are. The tragedy is that most people cannot believe what's really going on today in this skullduggery that is being utilized to change America forever. Well, with us is William Federer, and he's had the opportunity to give a number of talks, basically back in Washington, D.C., to some of the leaders of this country, giving them the history of Mexico, because most people don't know Mexican history, and they need to know Mexican history to understand much of what's going on today. So without further ado, William Federer, thank you very much for being with us.
With you, Dr. Stan.
Okay, you pick up the story.
Well, it's well known that the Indians of the Americas came across the Bering Strait some 5,000 plus years ago. They immigrated all around North America, Central America, Latin America. The major Mayan culture was around 250 A.D. to 900 A.D. But then the Aztec Indians, which is another name for them is the Mexica, or that's where we get the name Mexican. Indians had a kingdom from 1325 A.D. to 1521 A.D. And very well civilized as far as its social structures and the buildings and so forth. Unfortunately, it had a religion that worshipped the sun and believed they had to sacrifice humans to keep the sun burning. And so the Aztec temples down in Mexico would sacrifice on the average 20,000 people a year. It's estimated when they built their huge temple there in Mexico City, Tenochtitlan, that 80,000 people had their hearts ripped out at that time. Anyway, around the time that Columbus began to sail, there in Mexico, they had many mysterious things happening, like the lake began to boil. Mexico City was on a lake in a volcanic basin and an island which with causeways that went out to it, which have since been filled in, all except one small part of it, which is still a lake today. But the waters began bubbling in the lake. They were seeing comets in the sky. Voices of ladies screaming at nighttime, blowing in the wind, and then one was the emperor's, Montezuma's sister had appeared to have died, and while they were going through the ceremony, she had suddenly woke up and scared everybody and said she had a vision of men coming from the east on ships with big white sails with a cross on them. And
hold that thought, we'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. And our guest this afternoon is William Federer, is certainly one of my favorite guests. We carry a number of his books, America's God and Country, and then he puts out The American Minute, and he has written books on St. Patrick and St. Nicholas and George Washington Carver, and even on FDR and some of the things that FDR has said about this. And of course we'll tell you later how to get William's books. We carry a lot of them to Radio Liberty, but there's some we haven't got around to carrying, although they're all good books. But he's been giving talks recently on Mexican history, and of course it really starts with the Indians coming across the Bering Straits about 5,000 years ago, and then settling all throughout North America and to Mexico and South America, and this is where the Indian culture came from. And he's talking about the Aztec society, which was from the 1300s to the 1500s, and many, many things were happening shortly after Columbus discovered America, and some of the leaders of this Aztec culture were having premonitions that men were going to come in ships from the east, and of course those flags would have a cross on them, and the people would be wearing crosses on the uniform, on their armor. So you pick up the story there, William.
Well, Montezuma was very superstitious, and the stories in the Mexican culture was that Quetzalcoatl would someday return. He was their god, their feathered serpent god. The story was that he was a person that was a priest and was very holy, and then he was tricked into sinning, and then he wrapped himself up in a blanket and dove in a volcano, but that he would someday return and he would end human sacrifice. And so that was the thought. So when first of all, Columbus came in 1492. His first trip was fine. He was so good that on his second trip, he brought 2,000 Spanish settlers with him. They were expecting it to be get rich quick, easy gold, and then they discovered there were two different kinds of tribes in the Caribbean. One was the peaceful one, and the other were the Caribs. And the Caribs were known to depopulate islands through cannibalism. And they would go there and commit sodomy and kill the people and eat their children and so forth. I don't want to get into it all. But the reason I bring that up is to debunk the myth that Columbus destroyed a paradise, because the Caribs were very systematically wiping out the peaceful tribes, and to those that were being eaten, it was not a paradise.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment with William Federer. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William was just saying that, certainly when Columbus came to the Caribbean, there was cannibalism there, and many of the peaceful tribes were being taken over by the other tribes who were frankly cannibals and rather ruthless, and so the Caribbean was not at all a area of paradise. Yes, there were some very peaceful islands until these warring tribes came in and simply slaughtered everyone there and ordinarily just had them for dinner. So pick up the story there, William.
So it's important to understand that, because when Cortez decided to leave Cuba and in 1521 sailed with 500 men to Mexico, he landed at Vera Cruz, which means true cross in Spanish. He began to attack the Aztec Empire, but the tribes who had been subjugated by the Aztecs looked at Cortez as their deliverer, and they didn't want to have to give their young men and women up every year to be sacrificed to keep the sun burning. And so that's one of the reasons why, with just 500 men, Cortez was able to conquer the entire Aztec Empire.
Because a lot of these natives actually joined with him. They wanted to do away with the Aztec kingdom, didn't they?
Well, they did. And Cortez, when he entered Mexico City for the first time, Montezuma was not sure if he was the Quetzalcoatl god returned or if he was just a person. But lo and behold, the ships they came on fit the description with the big crosses on them, and their helmets all had crosses on them. So they went into Mexico City and took the Montezuma captive. And another part of the story, a group of other Spaniards landed on Mexico and were marching toward Mexico City. And Cortez evidently didn't want to let them get the heads up on him. So he left his second-in-command in charge, went out to fight them. In the course of fighting him, one of his soldiers came into contact with one of these other soldiers who had contracted smallpox. And so when Cortez went back into Mexico City and then found out that his men that he left in charge, killed a bunch of the Indians and started an uprising, and so Cortez had to flee the city. Montezuma died in the situation there. They fled the city, and a whole lot of his men died, including the one that had contracted the smallpox. And so his body was left in the city. When Cortez came back the next year, the story is that his men basically had to step over bodies, that there were just dead bodies lying everywhere from the smallpox. And that was one of the reasons that this plague basically destroyed more people than the cruelty of the Spaniards did. Well, Cortez immediately began tearing down the temples and building churches. Unfortunately, the Mexican system of society broke down into the Spanish landowners and the poor Indians. And in the middle, there were some Spanish-Indian mixes, because the Spanish did intermarry quite a bit, and they were considered a higher class than just the Indians. But the encomienda system, which Columbus unfortunately started, was to give a plot of land to these Spanish lords, and whatever Indians happened to be on that land, they were supposed to take care of. Well, taking care of turned into making slaves out of. And the matter of fact, the first 10 years from 1521 to 1531, there was a big debate raging in Europe as to whether or not the Indians had souls. And finally it was decided they did have souls, and the Catholic Church attempted to be somewhat of a conscience for the wealthy Spanish, who really were set on just getting rich, and they could care less about the natives. So there was a Bartolomé de las Casas, who was called the apostle to the Indians, and he began writing these books that got published around Europe, documenting the atrocities that took place. And that put pressure on the monarchs to put pressure on these Spanish landlords to not be so cruel. But one of the stories that happened that's worth noting is the Indians were considering having an uprising. And around 1535 is when Juan Diego reported to have had a vision of the Virgin Mary, Our Lady of Guadalupe. And it happened to be on the hill of Tenancin, which was where the ancient Aztecs worshipped the mother goddess. And so when he had this vision, and he picked flowers and put it in his poncho, and when he went before the bishop, he let his poncho down, and there was the Our Lady Guadalupe picture. That's the story. But when this was put up, the Indians saw this as replacing their pagan goddess with this new religion. And so literally millions, 15 million Indians converted to Catholicism in just a few years. They had had lines in churches where they would just stream in 10,000 a day, and they would just baptize them. Many became sincere, but as you could imagine, without the proper teaching, many did the syncretism where they would mix some of their pagan religions in with the Catholic traditions, and that was always a challenge there for the church. Meanwhile, this is important because this goes into the makeup of Mexico today, where today 89% of Mexicans are Catholic. And the landlords were very oppressive, and the Catholic Church sort of stayed with the status quo of not wanting to throw out the landlords. The democratic ideas of America hadn't come into existence yet. And so they felt like they were going to be the conscience for the landlords to prevent the abuse of the poor. Well, America won its independence, and then when Napoleon decided to invade Spain and put his brother on the throne of Spain, the Mexicans decided that they were going to follow America's example and rebel. And they had two rebellions going on at once. You had the poor rebelling against the rich landowners, and then you had the rich landowners who were rebelling against Spain, and they simply wanted to set up a monarchy in Mexico. They didn't want to give rights to all these poor peasants. And so the problem was Miguel Hidalgo was the priest who started the Spanish Revolution in 1810. But he was quickly killed and put down. His uprising of peasants was put down. They had a 10-year war. Finally, in 1820, before they came up with a Mexican constitution model, very similar to our U.S. Constitution, except that it didn't lift the poor people up, and it established the Catholic Church as the official Church of Mexico. And then you had a series of the next 100 years of lots of killings where one general would take over and he would kill the next general who would take over, and really made you appreciate George Washington, who, after he defeated the British, he resigned his commission and went back to farming. He didn't try to make himself emperor, which he very well could have. So what happened in Mexico was the they declared their independence. There was a general named Iturbide, I-T-U-R-B-I-D-E, and he simply wanted to set up a monarchy in Mexico and keep the Catholic Church as the official church. Wanted to have some kind of equality, but not a whole lot. And he established his constitution, but he didn't last long and was killed. Actually, only one president of Mexico in that first 100 years finished his term. There was always some type of revolution. And then in 1835 is when Santa Anna became the dictator. And he threw out their constitution completely, and he just began to enforce his own will as law, and several states began to rebel. Yucatan, San Luis Potosi, Chiapas, and Texas was one of the states that rebelled against Santa Anna being the dictator. Well, Santa Anna went around from one province to another, killing people. I mean, one place he defeated them and let his men ravage the city for 48 hours. Another place, there was an army of federal troops coming out to stop Santa Anna, and this is in Mexico, and he captures them all and kills all the captured enemy. He wanted to have the reputation of being ruthless, and then Tejas rebelled against him, and of course we know the story where the Stephen F. Austin and Samuel Houston fought. We had the Battle of the Alamo, where every single one of the 189 defenders was killed by Santa Anna. There's some reports that not all of them died in the battle, and he took them out afterwards and executed them. But we do know for a fact that after the Alamo, there was only one army in the field, and that was Colonel Fannin's army that had just left Goliad heading toward San Antonio to try to help him. Little did they know that the battle was already over. Anyway, they get mired down with their cannons in the muddy ground and get stuck, and they're surrounded in the open field by Santa Anna's men, who captured 385 of them and put them in prison there at Goliad. And then the word comes up from Santa Anna to kill them all. Well, the Mexican commander didn't want to, so Santa Anna sent up another replacement commander who took all 385 of those Texans out in the field and killed them. And so that is what stirred up national and international abhorrence for Santa Anna, and America did step in, and Texas became a state in 1845, and we still had trouble with Santa Anna, and so we had the war with Mexico of 1848, and that was the war where Robert E. Lee helped our troops get down into the city, a miraculous battle to get past all their defenses, very small loss of life, and for $15 million, we had the treaty where we got California, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, Utah from Mexico, and this set the stage for them to have Benito Juarez be their next leader.
All right, fine. We're going to have to take a break there, and I assume that is the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo?
Right, of 1848.
Yeah, so 1848, that's very important, because a lot of the Mexican nationalists today are saying, we stole the land. No, we bought the land from them, you know, legitimately, and the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. Well, William, go ahead, pick up the story there.
Well, it's important to bring out that the Spanish claim to those lands, and I'm referring to Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, their claims stemmed from conquistadors simply walking across the land. When the conquistadors came looking for the seven cities of Silboa, looking for the Fountain of Youth and all those things, just the mere fact that they walked across the land was all they did to lay claim to it. So they had not developed it. They had not settled it. They had very, very few people that actually lived on that land. So it was very, in today's view, there's no way people would consider that a legitimate claim to somebody's property just by walking across it. Certainly the Indians were walking across it all day long, and they should have had claim to it. But so when the question is raised that we took that land away from Mexico, Mexico only had it because Spain had it, and Spain only had it because conquistadors walked across it. So it's not a real solid claim that Mexicans can have today to say, well, we want those states back. Nevertheless, we did purchase those states for $15 million. Benito Juarez became the next significant ruler, and the wealthy decided that they didn't like Juarez standing up for the poor. Juarez also pushed through a constitution where he did take away rights from the Catholic Church, and so they appealed to Austria and got Maximilian to come over to be the French Emperor of Mexico. And this guy is sort of sad because he did not even know there was a revolution going on. The stories that the wealthy had presented to him in Austria was that, you know, this would be his little kingdom, and he'd be able to, and he really wanted to give rights to people, really wanted to stand up for the individual freedoms and let it be a process. But Benito Juarez didn't want any emperor, no matter how benevolent he was. And so Benito Juarez finally captured Maximilian and executed him. During this time, the story is that Lincoln liked Juarez, thought he was standing up for the common person, and supposedly had our troops lose some supplies along the border to help Benito Juarez. And there's actually a statue of Benito Juarez in Washington, D.C., right across from the Watergate building. Anyway, when he died, Porfino Diaz took over in 1867, and he was in favor of the Catholic Church and the ruling class. He was in for 30 years, was known for having all kinds of fixed elections where they would act like they're having an election and nobody would vote for him, but he'd get in overwhelmingly. So in 1910 is when Madero decided to have a rebellion against Porfino Diaz. And Madero was your typical murderer type person, and his gangs went out and would kill and steal. And when Teddy Roosevelt, in his book that was written in 1917, Teddy Roosevelt has a book called Fear God and Take Your Own Part, and in there he talks about Madero's men coming into Texas, and where a lady was cooking, and they went into her house and made her cook for them. And evidently they shot her and made her get up from the floor and keep cooking while she was bleeding to death. And then the little boy came to the door.
Hold that thought. We're back just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest is William Federer, and we're talking about really the successive authoritarian structures and societies that existed in Mexico. And, of course, you had some people there who really wanted to help the common people. There were others, of course, who wanted to help the ruling class. And it was this constant battle back and forth within Mexico as to who was going to be in charge. And, of course, what we have to do is fast forward to today, where in Mexico we have just a very few billionaires. We have probably 20 or more billionaires. They have more billionaires in Mexico than they do in all the rest of South America put together. And then you have a small ruling class, and then you have an impoverished class. And it is because that impoverished class, looking for a better way of life, are the ones that are coming across our border illegally and, of course, settling here in America. And somewhere between 20 and, according to Dr. Jerome Corsi and Jim Kilquist, are coming out with a new book, they think there may be as many as 30 million illegal immigrants. You can be sure that the figure at least of 10 or 11 million or 11 or 12 million is not true. The government always lies to us, and I think they're lying again. So pick up the story now. You're talking, though, where the period, what, the end of the 1800s or somewhere in there?
Right, this is 1910.
1910, all right.
And the new emperor of Mexico is Madero. He styled himself as a president, and Teddy Roosevelt writes in his book, he's quoting from Senator Fall, who's speaking in the U.S. Senate. And he talked about how on June 12, 1911, there was a Mrs. Anderson, a poor woman living with her children, and soldiers from Madero's army entered her house, demanded that she cook for them. She was shot, fell to the ground, compelled to rise from the ground and continue to cook, although bleeding to death. At the same time, her little daughter, 13 years old, was crying, and a neighbor boy came running to the door, and they shot him. But, you know, this is Teddy Roosevelt documenting this stuff. Anyway, Madero didn't put, he got in power, but he didn't put his general in charge of a powerful enough area, and that General Huerta decides to rebel against Madero. And so Huerta makes himself the new emperor, and that's at the time when the U.S. starts to get involved, because the U.S. had oil interests, oil companies, you know, the Standard Oil people, owned wells down around Tampico, north of Veracruz. And we sent, Woodrow Wilson sent our American Navy down there to protect those interests. And there was even a case where some men went ashore to get some supplies, and Huerta's men captured them. And we were, it was during this time that the British intercepted a telegram from the Kaiser Wilhelm in Germany to Huerta in Mexico, and sending over a boatload of rifles to have Mexico make a treaty with Germany to fight us in World War One.
That was known as the Zimmerman Telegram.
The Zimmerman Telegram. Right. And and then
and that was the excuse that was used to get America into the war. That was they used that and said, well, the Germans are trying to get the Mexicans to attack us. We've got to go to war with Germany. And that wasn't exactly the way it was, but our leaders wanted to get into war in Europe, and so they used the Zimmerman telegram. Go ahead.
So, anyway, Woodrow Wilson helped get Huerta out of office, and he helped put in another bandito named Carranza. And Carranza was just as bad, and no sooner was Carranza in than he had a split with Pancho Villa, and so Pancho Villa was upset at America for supporting Carranza instead of him, and so Pancho Villa takes out his wrath against the Americans, and he wages war. He actually comes across the border in Columbus, New Mexico, and attacks and kills a bunch of people. There's a whole, you know, 17 Americans were on a train going through Mexico, and he took them all off and killed them. You know, there was over 500 engineers were working with the railroads and so forth, and they were killed and driven out of the country. And then in the bottom part of the country, there was Emiliano Zapata, who was fighting for the poor, but then his outlaws became unruly, and sort of like MS-13 gangs. I mean, we're talking about, it's just gang rule, and there was no order, and the government wasn't powerful enough to restore order. Carranza put out a assassination thing on Zapata and had him killed. Pancho Villa was later assassinated. But prior to his assassination, Woodrow Wilson sent General Pershing into Mexico with 30,000 troops to try to catch Pancho Villa, and was chasing him around the mountains and hills. And Carranza didn't help us because he wouldn't let us use their trains, and it just became where we were stalemated, and we finally pulled out. But Woodrow Wilson did send probably close to 100,000 National Guardsmen down to the border, because the Mexicans were simply shooting across the border, killing people in their living rooms, and then, unfortunately, at the same time, they put in the new 1917 Constitution of Mexico, which retaliated against the Catholic Church.
All right, you hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess it's William Federer, and you're getting a history lesson on Mexican history. So pick up the story there. Now, basically, you have your 1917 Mexican Constitution that's passed, and, of course, at that time, Woodrow Wilson is in the White House. Woodrow Wilson, of course, is intent on getting America into the First World War, so he's not that concerned about Mexico. So did the Constitution then settle things down a little bit?
Actually, not right away. One of the things I was going to mention with Pancho Villa running around the country, and General Blackjack Pershing was down there. His assistant was George Patton, and so George Patton got his training for World War II by originally fighting there in Mexico, sort of the same way that all of the generals on the North and the South during our Civil War both fought together in Mexico in 1848. But the situation down there was so terrible with this 1917 Constitution, which took all land away from the Catholic Church, and for that matter, all churches, but the Catholic Church was the main church. It says, this is, I'm quoting from the Constitution, says, religious corporations, ministers of religion, shall not in any way participate in institutions giving elementary, secondary, or normal education. So religious organizations could no longer teach. The state will not allow, it says, the state cannot permit the execution of any contract where there's a loss of personal liberty, and it interprets that to saying vows for religious orders. And so it abolished all vows for religious orders, saying that you can't voluntarily give up your rights. It's like twisting it. They said that all property belonged to the church. It says that every religious act of public worship must be performed strictly inside of places of public worship, which shall at all times be under governmental supervision. Churches may in no case hold or acquire property. And this is just the wording of it. What happened in actual practice is whole, you know, convents of nuns were raped. Here's Teddy Roosevelt giving a report here. He says that the refugees included the archbishop, seven archbishops, six bishops, hundreds of priests, 300 nuns. Most of these bishops and priests were put in jail. Two-thirds of the institutions of higher learning in Mexico were confiscated and destroyed. It says 100 priests from one city were rounded up, told they had to raise $1,000,000 pesos in 24 hours or they'd all be killed.
Hold that thought. We're back here in just a moment with our friend William Federer. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is just telling us that in 1917 they came up with a new constitution. It was very much anti-church. In fact, they confiscated the property of the church, and they really mistreated, and they actually killed a number of nuns and priests. And of course, what people have to do is put it into perspective, because it was at this time, 1917, when, of course, the Communist Revolution took place in Russia, the March Revolution, the October Revolution, the World Communist Revolution was underway, and one of the major thrusts of the Communist Revolution was to destroy Christianity. And so there were those influences that were in Mexico as well. Wouldn't that be a fair statement, Bill?
Oh, that's exactly the same thing. It was a very socialist revolution that took place in Mexico. You know, their constitution says it's the right of everybody to be educated. I mean, it sounds very similar to some of the statements in the Soviet Constitution.
Well, of course, and then the other thing is, you have to understand that under socialism, stripped of all of its wonderful idealistic humanitarian concepts, it is really a power structure. Socialism is a sincere, benevolent, idealistic theory, but it doesn't work unless somebody is in charge at the top. And that is why that in socialist countries, you have a very, very wealthy ruling elite. And then, of course, you have a very small middle class, and everybody else is enslaved. That is what communism and socialism are really about. But, of course, that's not what they teach you in college. So you pick up this story. You have a revolution, and, of course, you have a new constitution, 1917.
And, you know, it was shocking to me, Stan, to do my research and realize that this horror went on so close to America, and really this has not been taught at all, that it was basically gangs that ruled the country, and they've since instituted into the PRI, the Revolutionary Party. But in 1970, and I'm quoting from Teddy Roosevelt's book, he says that they would not allow more than two masses a week. They prohibited confession. They prohibited more than one priest living in one county, and they did not allow. It says, finally, the prohibition of more than one priest living in Toluca, and the requirement that priests, when they walk in the streets, shall be dressed absolutely as a civilian without anything in their costume revealing the fact that they are ministers. He goes on to say, all the Catholic schools were closed in Mexico. The Carmelite nuns talked about the churches being profaned by soldiers on horseback, breaking statues, riding through the church, trampling relics, scattering the sacred hosts and throwing them into the horses' feet, and mock masses and orgies around the altar. And it says the prioress of one convent states that she had seen in Mexico nuns who had been victims of passion by the revolutionary officers, which is a nice way of saying raped, and that they were in hospitals and maternity houses. Well, you know, and says who, in the consequence, are about to be delivered of children. He says, I've seen soldiers dressed up in the priest's outfits, in the stoles, with ropes and linen, and several nuns who had been raped, and one said that she cursed the day that she took her profession. But it was out of this horror that the Mexican government took over, and this is still the constitution that they have today. So all church property in Mexico is owned by the government, and they recently, just within the last 10-15 years, made it so that priests and ministers can walk out in public wearing their religious clothes, and they've had different citizens that push through changes where churches can form associations, and you can have your church members be members of the association, and therefore the association can own property, so you can have your property without it going to the government. But it was a very horrible secular purging that went on, that's where it is today as far as the country goes. Now, it's still broken up, as you had mentioned, between the extreme wealthy, which had been the Spaniards, but now they're just the ones that that end up with the money, and then the mestizos, which are Spanish and American mixes, and then the poor Indians are at the bottom of the ladder. And we see that Eisenhower had a amnesty for security switch. He allowed the Mexicans that had come across to become citizens and promised to secure the borders, and that lasted for a couple years. Kennedy had a big change. Kennedy initiated, and then LBJ signed into law, the Immigration Act of 1965, and this radically changed the immigration quotas for America. Prior to then, most of the immigrants to the country came from the European countries. They tended to assimilate more, have the same faith, the same view, very hard working, ended up becoming business owners and becoming Republican. And the demographics showed that the immigrants from poorer countries tended to be more dependent on the state and tended to vote Democrat. And so Kennedy changed the immigration quotas to allow more immigrants from poorer countries to basically solidify the Democrat hold on the vote. And even Bill Clinton, we've witnessed that. In the the last time he ran, where he actually sent letters to illegal immigrants with fake voting cards on there with their name printed on it, telling them that they could use that. And Ronald Reagan had been pressured through Congress to allow an amnesty security action.
That was the law of immigration law of 1986.
Right,
and that's where they told us there were a million illegal immigrants. Would make them all, make them all legal, and then it turned out they were wrong. There were 2.7 million illegal immigrants who became American citizens. So they swore there was only a million at that time. Why should we believe them now?
Well, and also the promise was that let's go ahead and grant these amnesty, and then the problem will be taken care of. But as we've seen, it basically just dangles a carrot out in front of those that want to come in to say, this is the doors are open.
But of course, Ronald Reagan promised to enforce the border, to secure the border. They were going, of course, to make it illegal for people to unknowingly hire illegal aliens. All the things were in the legislation that would have stopped illegal immigration. it was just that the Reagan administration, and then the Bush administration, and then the Clinton administration, and then the second Bush administration refused to enforce the laws of our land. And we have to ask, why is that?
And then one of the big changes happened under Bill Clinton, where he pushed through NAFTA. And the North American Free Trade Agreement allowed for businesses to move into Mexico and provide goods cheaper than the Mexicans could make them. So, for example, the Walmarts would move in there and sell stuff made in China cheaper than the Mexicans could make it, and literally tens of thousands of Mexican businesses closed down.
And we did the same thing with corn. They opened the border, and now we're sending in all of our subsidized corn grown in America, subsidized by our government, then we could undersell the Mexicans, since we already had poor Mexican farmers, and suddenly they're poorer than ever, thanks to, of course, to NAFTA, which is supposed to help them.
And, you know, a little farmer in Chiapas with his one cow farming on his little plot of grand land can't compete to these huge combines with all the genetically engineered high-yield corn and so forth. And so they've been able to move into these and provide corn in Mexico cheaper than the Mexicans can grow it themselves. And anyway, long story short, this has destabilized a lot of the farmers, and millions of them. And so when they immediately had NAFTA, they had maquiladores along the border in Mexico where Americans could invest, build factories, and then the Mexicans would come up and work in these things for very cheap. And so that was the migration, the carrot. So in southern Mexico and even Guatemala, Latin America, all these poor farmers would try to immigrate north to work in these maquilador factories, and a year and a half of them being open, they all shut them down because the factory owners could make stuff cheaper in China. And so, but once they were already displanted, they were already in North Mexico, it was very easy for them to say, let's just take a stab at coming across the border. So, and then the coup de grace is that when this began happening, investments started to leave Mexico, and so the Mexican government decided, in order to make Mexico attractive for investments, they wanted to devalue the peso. And so they actually made the peso worth half. And so what these little poor Mexican farmers could buy with, you know, 10 pesos, now it would take 20 pesos to buy the same thing. So a huge economic upheaval. And again, that is what caused them to leave their farms and their communities and come north to try to get in. So we basically created, Bill Clinton created the problem that, you know, Al Gore, they voted for this to cause these people to want to come up in the first place. And so it's important to realize how, you know, our country created the mess by pushing through NAFTA. And then the other thing that's important, and I know you talk about it a lot, Dr. Stan, is the global trade blocks. And if you, Phyllis Schlafly had a newsletter of last June or July where she talked about these. And then also anybody can go to Wikipedia and type in trade blocks, and it will pull up all these trade blocks from around the world. The EU, the Southeast Asian countries, the Caribbean countries, the Arab states, and the Russian ones, all these different trade blocks that are around the world, and their goals. So you see the graph at the bottom of the Wikipedia page, where it have one column that will say can travel freely from country to country without a visa. The next it says have a common currency. Next it says a trade pack. You just look a couple columns over, and it says borderless.
And I think that's what it's all about. I think people have to understand it is to do away with our borders. It is to do away with our sovereignty. It is to do away with our court system. It is to do away even with our money and with our locally elected government, and put everything into international control. This is what it's all about. That's why George Bush refuses to secure our borders, because he's already made an agreement you know, with the president of Mexico and the president of, or the premier of Canada, to do away with our nationhood. It was, it's called Rebuilding a North American Community. You can go up to the Council on Foreign Relations website, pull it down. You can pull it down. The plan is all there. They're already planning. They already have their study groups out, and they're not telling the Congress, they're not telling the people, because they have a different agenda, and they're much smarter than we are. They know what's better for us. They believe in a world government, and this is the first step along the way. Isn't that true, Bill?
Well, it is. There's a friend of mine, Alan Franklin, publishes the Hampshire Star newspaper in London, has about 250,000 circulation, and he has been documenting the EU and how it started originally as a trade agreement to help the country, and then it gradually has been putting its tentacles into taking away British sovereignty and having the EU with its unelected commissioners making decisions that affect every single aspect of life in Britain, almost making their parliament a useless body, that it doesn't really make any laws because the EU laws supersede them all. And that they talked about in their European newspapers of wanting to have 10 major trading blocks around the world. The African states, they just last year started the Commonwealth of Africa, the Southeast Asia ones. They want the North America to be one block, and then eventually pass the CAFTA, which they just did with the Central American Free Trade Agreement, and then the FTAA, the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas. And so basically all of the Americas will be one trading block. And then in their articles, they talk about how this is much easier for these 10 major trading blocks to work together to have a global government, a global economy. And the problem is that human nature is driving this, because we all want stuff cheaper. And in order for stuff to be cheaper, they need to be allowed to move production to the cheapest labor areas. But, you know, it's interesting. I was reading how the Incan Empire fell. And the Incan Empire was so advanced, it had different areas that produced different things, and they would all use their highly developed road system to bring them together and manufacture it, and everybody would benefit. But once one area was wiped out by the smallpox plague, then all the other areas couldn't make up for that piece of the puzzle of their economy that was missing. And so it basically makes the world a very vulnerable place. And that's one of the studies I did on the fall of the Roman Empire, because Rome, in its later stages in the 5th century, had extended its boundaries too far, and it had trouble protecting these boundaries, and the Rhine River Valley was being overrun by the tribe called Visigoths. And the Visigoths at first came across slowly, and they would assimilate, and they would learn Latin, the language, and they would learn respect for the Roman form of government, the Republican representative form of government. But then, I mean, you can trace it back a few centuries earlier when China built the Great Wall of China. The Mongols could no longer attack south into China, so they began attacking north and west, and that tribe would fight them for a century or two, and then they would finally give up, and they would turn and attack west, and that would displace another tribe, and that would just sort of like dominoes falling across Russia and so forth. They finally threw Eastern Europe, and then finally they would overrun, and the Visigoths began coming across the Rhine River into the Roman Empire. And then following them was the Ostrogoths, and then the Lombards, and the Jutes, and the Anglos, and the Saxons, and one of the tribes was called the Vandals. You can imagine what they did when they went through Rome. They vandalized. That's where that word came from. And Rome, meanwhile, had its military stretched around the world, putting out global fires. And when these immigrants came across so fast, they didn't learn the Latin language. They kept their own tribal languages. They didn't learn respect for the Roman form of government. They kept their own tribal sort of gang government, you know. And Rome had basically crumbled from the inside with its preoccupation with violent entertainment in the Colosseums. It had a huge high tax rate because of all these military situations supporting their military troops from North Africa up to Britain. They had their homosexual bathhouses and their all kinds of immorality. The Roman Empire was greatly in debt, so much so that they had taxes so high. One historian said the tax collector was worse than the enemy. And then you look at their equivalent of abortion was exposure of unwanted infants. They would just leave them out to die if a father didn't want the baby. Meanwhile, Rome had outsourced all its grain production to North Africa. And so when the Vandals came through Europe and went through Spain into North Africa, they captured those grain fields, and the Romans couldn't have enough resources to mount a counterattack, and it brought the Roman Empire to a close.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course it was Cicero who said the budget should be balanced, public spending should be reduced, the arrogance of officials should be tempered, and assistance to foreign lands should be curtailed, lest Rome go bankrupt. And of course, nobody heeded him, and Rome did go bankrupt. Bill, pick up this story. We've got 3 minutes to wrap it up.
Well, back in the 1950s, a lot of the UN people were saying the way to have world peace is interdependence instead of independence. That if the whole world is knit together with treaties and every country being a supplier or a market for another country, that you won't have to worry about wars because nobody's going to attack their supplier or their market. The only problem is this leaves out human nature, which is the greed and ambition that has been the source of war since the beginning of time. And so America has basically voluntarily caused ourselves to be interdependent, that we're no longer independent, and we're at a position where we get so much stuff from China that if we ever decide to stand up to them, if they're going to try to take Taiwan, all they have to do is dump all the debt that they've bought of ours, and our stock market will go crashing, and they can hold back their ships for a couple months, and our Walmart shelves will go empty, and we'll be brought to our knees economically. So.
And I would also point out that we only now have about 59 days of food left. Our wheat supplies are gone, our corn supplies are gone, and we would be facing the same situation that the Romans were 2,000 years ago.
And, they wouldn't do it forever. They'd just do it long enough to have our country put pressure on the politicians to capitulate, which I'm sure they would. It just is, one of the situations that the immigration, it's a piece that fits into the puzzle. And there is that schizophrenia where one half says secure the borders, and then the other half sees that, well, there are these multinational corporations that want there to be no borders for the sake of the bottom line, but the loyalty is to the bottom report on the New York Stock Exchange. It's not to the sovereignty of America. So we're in a situation where it's going to take a lot to turn us around, we've always seen situations where the country's been through this in the past, and hopefully we can turn the situation around.
Well, of course, it's been said of those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it, and as Thomas Jefferson said, a nation that expects it can be both free and ignorant in a state of civilization expects what it never was and never will be. That's why what Bill has told you today is so vitally important. You need to understand the history of the past. Bill, how can people get to your website?
Oh, AmericanMinute.com is my website, AmericanMinute.com.
No, hold that thought. I want you to give it to as soon as we bring all of our other stations right back on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan. If any of you would like to get the complete tape of our program, it is available through Radio Liberty at 1-800-544-8927. But I want you to get Bill Federer's website. Bill, get your website and telephone number out there.
Oh, thanks, Dr. Stan. It's AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com, and people can sign up for the free daily email or buy any one of the dozen books that I've written. And then the other way to contact me is a toll-free telephone. It's 888-USA-WORD, 888-USA-WORD.
And let me tell you, those books are outstanding. It's always a pleasure having you with us. Thank you very much, Bill.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, our guest then has been Bill Federer, and I always enjoy having Bill. We have a number of a four-tape set. We do carry his book on Santa Claus, on St. Patrick, on George Washington Carver, his book on America's God and Country, which I keep right beside me here when I'm doing my programs, and it's available both on book or CD, or I recommend you get both. A wonderful gift for people who are really concerned about America's godly heritage. And then to really understand what's going on with immigration, you need to get our 4-tape set on immigration. You need to get our book entitled Importing Immigration. It goes into how the Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation and all of these people who have no loyalty to America, who hate America, whose goal is a one-world government, how they're financing this whole illegal immigration movement, and how George Bush is helping them. So you need, of course, to get the Importing Revolution, our 4-tape set on immigration. We carry the book Fighting Immigration Anarchy. That's Fighting Immigration Anarchy. We have a DVD entitled The Conquest of Aztlan, where you'll actually hear many of the Mexican nationalists talk about how they're going to take over our country. And you must understand that this is all planned for the emotional impact on you. You are being manipulated. You're not being told the truth. Certainly, I think the best story will be my May newsletter. It'll be available in a few weeks. If you'd like to get a free copy of it, we'll be glad to send it to you if you are a subscriber. We apologize for being late, but our May newsletter really explains what this is all about, because nothing is as it appears to be. Behind this whole movement towards world government is much more than a desire for the bottom line and money. It's a desire to destroy America. It's a belief that what we will have is a one-world government with a one-world leader, and of course that will be the Antichrist. They know exactly what they're doing, because they're people who worship the Antichrist. That's why you need to get my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. The Brotherhood of Darkness. And you can get it with a DVD or video or just simply an audio tape. You need to get our pamphlets on the occult hierarchy that rules the world, because you see, ladies and gentlemen, there is another dimension. And if you understand there is a dimension, we hear a lot of these people who talk about UFOs. Oh my goodness, what are they? The little green men? Are they imaginary? No, they're very real, but they're not little green men. They're beings from another dimension. You need to get our interviews with Johanna Michelson, who is a medium. You see the medium on television, you think it's an interesting program about this wonderful lady who helps the DA catch the bad guys. The truth of the matter is she is contacting the beings from another dimension. You need to get my interviews with Johanna Michelson, The Beautiful Side of Evil, or the 4-tape set we have, The Supernatural. And as you begin to understand, we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. Most people have no idea what this is all about, and that there really are secret societies out there, where the leaders of our country are involved with all of these secret societies, and there are many of them. They're not just one or two. There are a multitude of them. But they all have one goal, a new world order and a new world religion. And behind everything going on today is a powerful, powerful conspiracy against God and an effort to destroy Christianity. You see it every day in our schools and our media. And, of course, please call us at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.